Hello, good evening. On behalf of the Free Library, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's event with Richard Price. My name is Dwayne Swierczynski. I'm a local journalist, or was until about a month ago. I'm here to introduce Richard. And you probably noticed this disturbing trend out there where a lot of people are passing off fiction as nonfiction. I mean, most recently there was Margaret Jones' piece, Love and Consequences, if you heard about this book, where it was like she allegedly was a child in a foster home with gang-style warfare outside. And it turns out she wasn't quite a foster child. She was more of a suburban kid, went to a private school, didn't really see any Crips or Bloods much. There was the James Frey book, of course, A Million Little Pieces, where he claimed to have, been, sent to Alcatraz for 40 years. Not quite, but, he had long stay in prison for his drug use. And not quite. It kind of came out things a little differently. And what's funny is these, people who want to pass off fiction as nonfiction, almost like they're cheating. It's like Frankenstein with his monster. He wants that kind of lightning strike from the heavens to hit the dead corpse. And it's like, instead of, my God, it's alive, it's like, my God, I'm telling the truth. This is a true story. Read this thing, And it's a cheating thing. And I don't know why that is, because you can mix the two, fiction and reality. It's not vodka and sleeping pills. I mean, you can mix the two safely if you're, careful about it. David Simon, who was the creator of the HBO series The Wire, does it all the time. He calls it stealing life, where you take things from reality and plug it into your fiction, your stories you tell. And he's great at this thing. The show is like one of the best shows on TV. And it's no surprise that David Simon tapped, enlisted Richard Price to write for the show, because Price is the master, I believe, of stealing life and taking reality and putting it into his fiction. A lot of crime writers who I'm friends with, or mystery writers, every time a Richard Price novel appears, they stop everything and go right to that Richard Price novel, because it's just the raw deal. It's the real deal. It's a hit of reality unlike you don't get anywhere else in fiction. And we actually want to share two quotes from two of my favorite writers on Price. One is George Pelicanos, who says that, basically that Clockers was the Grapes of Wrath of our generation, and that his books are a record of America at a certain time. They've really pinned down a certain time. Dennis Lehane also wrote that Clockers was like a grenade going off in a foxhole. This right here, he said, is literature. It's what it's supposed to do. And that's the key for me. I mean, I think what I've read a lot of interviews recently with Richard, where he claims he doesn't do research. He doesn't do kind of like classic book research. And I believe him. He's not out there asking questions to find certain answers to things, but he's more absorbing life, like a battery absorbing the raw material around him. And he immerses himself in a world, be it a drug-infested corner or a up-and-coming New York neighborhood. He absorbs the reality around him and uses that as his fiction. It's not it's not book research. It's street life. It's immersing yourself in street life, and that's what gives his novels power. So instead of Dr. Frankenstein, the sort of the cheating method of like grabbing lightning from the sky and hoping that it kind of can trick your readers into making you feel about your characters and your stories, Richard does it the hard way. He immerses himself in reality and really steeps himself in it, and it comes through in every page of his books. Latest being Lush Life, which if you've some of you probably have read it, tonight, and it's fantastic. It's all about a neighborhood that can be seen as like in two ways. And there's a great quote he's given to reviewers where it's like, if you look at a street corner and you see it for what it is, it's almost like the surface of an ocean. But you do a rattling of cops and dip below the surface with a snorkel mask, you can see the life teeming beneath that placid surface. And that's what he does in all of his books. So tonight he's here to discuss Lush Life with you and hopefully reveal a bit about his process into using reality and fiction safely. So please welcome Richard Price.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks. Is anybody here from my eighth grade homeroom? Tell me now, because I'll see you later and I won't remember. Okay. Thank you for that introduction. There is an old saying that the fact that something really happened is the defense of the mediocre novelist. I make up stuff on purpose. Lush Life is about the Lower East Side of New York. I've always wanted to write about the Lower East Side all my adult life, and it centers around a murder that's sort of a culture clash murder. I could talk about that a little bit later. Suffice it to say, I'm going to read a little bit from the prologue and a monologue. After that, the whole thing shouldn't take more than an hour and a half. Did I say something? The Lower East Side has gone through a recent transformation. It's gone from the most violent area in New York City to sort of like a La Boheme playground. The problem is, if you're a police commander there, you still have to hand in your quote-unquote productivity report to One Police Plaza at the end of the month. And if you don't have a lot of arrests, it looks like you're just twiddling your thumbs. So one of the things that in this book they institute is something they call the Quality of Life Squad, which four guys in a taxi, about 900 pounds of white meat with guns, sitting in a taxi that fools no one. And they, you know, basically profile the traffic coming over the Williamsburg Bridge into from Brooklyn into the Lower East Side. And if they see a likely bunch of heads, they get up behind it and see what they can shake loose. It's basically college for dollars or night fishing. So this is a typical prowl of the Quality of Life Squad. You'll hear four names of the four cops. It's Lugo, Gehagen, Daly, and Scharf. And the two kids they stopped, their names are Seriously and Fucked. At the corner of Houston and Christie, a cherry red Denali pulls up alongside them, three overdressed women in the back seat, the driver alone up front and wearing sunglasses. The passenger side window glides down. Offices, where the Howard Johnson Hotel at around here? Straight ahead, three blocks on the far corner, Lugo says. Thank you. What's with the midnight shades? Daly asks from the shotgun seat, leaning forward past Lugo to make eye contact. I got photosensitivity, the guy answers, tapping his frames. The window glides back up and he shoots east on Houston. Did he just call us offices? It's that stupid flat top of yours. It's that fucking tractor hat of yours. I got photosensitivity. A moment later, they're rolling past the Howard Johnsons themselves, watching as the guy from the Denali makes like a coachman, holding the door for all the ladies filing out from the back seat. Huggy bear, Lugo mumbles. Who the fuck puts a Howard Johnson's down here? Scharf gestures to the seedy-looking chain hotel. Its neighbors, an ancient knishery and a Seventh-day Adventist church, whose aluminum cross is superimposed over a stone-carved Star of David. What was the thinking behind that? 28 flavors, Lugo says. My dad used to take me every Sunday after my game. Oh, you're talking the ice cream parlor, Scharf says. That's different. I never had a dad, says Gehagen. You want one of mine? Daly turns in his seat. I had three. I can only dream of a dad who'd take me to a Howard Johnson's after my game. Hey, Sonny, Lugo catches Gehagen's eye in the rearview. Later tonight, do you want to have a catch with me? Sure, mister. Pokey as fuck out here, huh? Says Daly. That's because it's your turn to collar, Lugo says, waving off some drunk who thinks he's just flagged down a taxi. Somebody up there hates me. Hang on. Scharf abruptly perks up, his head on a swivel. That there looks good. High beams going west. Four bodies. Going west? Lugo floors it in heavy traffic. Think thin, girls, as he takes the driver's side wheels up onto the concrete divider to get past a real cab waiting for the light, then whips into a U-turn to get abreast of the target car, peering in. Females, two mommies, two kids, passing them, hungrier now, all of them. Then Scharf ahoying once again. Green Honda, going east. Now east, he says. Lugo does another 180 and pulls behind the Honda. All right, what do we got? Two males in the front. What do we got? Neon trim on the plate. Tinted windows. Right rear taillight. Front passenger, just stuff something under the seat. Thank you. Lugo hits the misery lights, climbs up the Honda's back, the driver taking a half a block to pull over. Daly and Lugo slowly walk up on either side of the car, cross-beam the front seats. The driver, a young green-eyed Latino, rolls down his window. Officer, what'd I do? Lugo rests his cross arms on the open window as if it's a backyard fence. License and registration, please? For real, what'd I do? You always drive like that? His voice almost gentle. Like what? Signaling lane changes, all road courteous and shit? Excuse me? Come on, nobody does that unless they're nervous about something. Well, I was. Nervous? You was following me. A cab was following you? Yeah, okay, a cab. Passing over his papers. All serious, officer. No disrespect intended. Maybe I can learn something here, but what did I do? Primary, you have neon trim on your plates. Hey, I didn't put it there. This is my sister's whip. Secondary, your windows are too dark. I told her about that. Tertiary, you crossed the solid yellow. To get around a double-parked car. Quadrary, you're sitting by a hydrant. That's because you just pulled me over. Lugo takes a moment to assess the level of mouth he's getting. As a rule, he is soft-spoken, leaning into the driver's window to conversate, to explain. His expression baggy with patience, going eye to eye as if to make sure what he's explicating here is being digested, seemingly deaf to the obligatory sputtering, the misdemeanors of verbal abuse. But if the driver says that one thing, goes one word over some invisible line, then without any change of expression, without any warning signs, except maybe a slow straightening up, a sad, disgusted looking off, he steps back, reaches for the door handle, and the world as they knew it is no more. But this kid isn't too bad. This is for your own benefit. Get out of the car, please. As Lugo escorts the driver to the rear bumpers, Daly leans into the shotgun seat window and tilts his chin at the passenger, the second kid sitting there affecting comatosity, heavy-lidded under a too-big baseball cap and staring straight ahead as if they were still driving somewhere. So what's your story, Daly says, opening the passenger door, offering this one some sidewalk, too. As Gahagan, all tatted out in Celtic braids, knots, and crosses, leans in to search the glove compartment, the cup caddy, the tape storage bin, Scharf taking the rear seats. Back at the bumpers, the driver stands in a scarecrow tee, looking off soul-eyed as Lugo, squinting through his own cigarette smoke, finger walks his pockets, coming up with a fat roll of 20s. It's a lot of cheddar, cuz, counting it, then stuffing it in the kid's shirt pocket before continuing to pat down. Yeah, well, that's my college tuition money. What the fuck? College takes cash, Lugo laughs. Then finished, gestures to the bumper. Have a seat. Burke Technical in the Bronx? It's new. And they take cash? Money's money. True that, Lugo shrugs, just waiting out the car search. So what's your major? Furniture management? You ever been locked up before? Come on, man, my uncle's like a detective in the Bronx. Like a detective? No, a detective. He just retired. Oh, yeah, what precinct? I don't know, per se. The 69th? The fighting 69th, Gahagan calls out, feeling under the passenger seat now. There is no 69th, Lugo says, flicking his button to the gutter. 60-something, I said I wasn't sure. What's his name? Rodriguez? Oh, Rodriguez in the Bronx? That narrows it down. What's his first name? Narciso? Don't know him. Had a big retirement party? Sorry. I've been thinking of trying out for the police academy myself. Oh, yeah, that's great. Oh, Donnie. Gahagan backs out of the passenger door, holds up a Ziploc of weed, because we need more fucking smoke hounds. The kid closes his eyes, tilts his chin to the stars, to the moon over Delancey. His or yours? Lugo gestures to the other kid on the sidewalk, face still blank as a mask, his pockets strewn over the car hood. Somebody needs to say or you both go. Mine, the driver finally mutters. Turn around, please. You gonna lock me up for that? Hey, 2 seconds ago you stepped up like a man. Stay with that. Lugo cuffs him, then turns him forward again, holding him at arm's length as if to assess his outfit for the evening. Anything else in there? Tell us now. We'll rip that shit box to shreds. Damn, man, I barely had that. All right, then just relax. Guiding him back down to the bumper as the search continues. The kid looks off, shakes his head, mutters, sorry ass. Excuse me? No, I'm just saying, purse in his mouth. Not about you. Gahagan comes back with the baggie, hands it over. Okay, look. Lugo lights another cigarette, takes a long first drag. This? We could give a fuck. We're out here on a higher calling. He nods at a passing patrol car, something the driver said, making him laugh. You know what I'm saying? More serious shit? There you go. That's all I got. I'm not talking about what you got. I'm talking about what you know. What I know? You know what I'm saying. They both turn and look off in the direction of the East River, two guys having a moment. One with his hands behind his back. Finally, the kid exhales heavily. Well, I can tell you where a weed spot is. You're kidding me, right? Lugo rears back. I'll tell you where a weed spot is. I'll tell you where 50 is. I can get you better shit than this for half what you paid 7 days a week with blindfolds on. The kid sighs, tries not to look at the barely curious locals coming out of the Banco de Ponce ATM Center and the Dunkin' Donuts. The college kids hopping in and out of taxis. Come on, do right by me, I'll do right by you. Lugo absently tosses the baggie from hand to hand, drops it, picks it up. Do right like how? I want a gun. A what? I don't know a gun. You don't have to know a gun, but you know someone who knows someone, right? Aw, man. For starters, you know who you bought this shit from, right? I don't know any guns, man. You got $40 of weed there. I paid for it with my own money because it helps me relax, helps me party. Everybody I know is like, go to work, go to school, get high, that's it. Huh. So, like, there's no one you could call, say, yo, I just got jacked into PJs. I need me a one-time whistle. Can I meet you at such and such? A whistle? Lugo makes a finger gun. Oh, you mean a hammer? A hammer, a whistle. Lugo turns away and tightens his ponytail. The kid looks off then. I know a knife. Lugo laughs. My mother knows a knife. This one's used. Forget it. Then chin tilting to the other kid. What about your sidekick there? My cousin? He's like half retarded. How about the other half? Come on. The driver lolls his head like a cow. Another patrol car rolls up. This one to pick up the prisoner. All right, just think about it, okay? Lugo says. I'll see you back in holding in a few hours. What about my car? Gilbert Grape there. He's got a license? His brother does. Well, then tell him to call his brother and get his ass down here before you wind up towed. Damn. Then calling out, Raymond, you hear that? The cousin nods but makes no move to retrieve his cell phone from the car hood. So you never answer my question, Lugo says, skull steering him into the rear of the cruiser. You ever been locked up before? The kid turns his head away, murmurs something. It's okay, you can tell me. I said yes. For? The kid shrugs, embarrassed, says, this? Yeah, around here? Uh-huh. How long back? On Christmas Eve. A Christmas Eve for this? Lugo winces. That is cold. Who the fuck would... Do you remember who collared you? Uh-huh. The kid mutters, then looks Lugo in the face. You? That went pretty fast, so I'm going to read two quick monologues. There's this white kid gets murdered, sort of like one of the Laboimers down there, and the media is on it, so they're turning the Lower East Side upside down, trying to find the robbery that had turned homicidal. And at one point, you know, Lower East Side right now, sort of like, if you read the papers, it belongs to these young kids from all over America. But there's about six other Lower East Sides that have been living there for at least a half a century, and nobody told them that they don't live there anymore, so they're still there. And this is a junkie who gets grabbed and trying to purse snatch in front of a Tony restaurant. And the first thing he says is, let me go, I'll let you know, I'll tell you who killed that white kid. So, of course, they ship him down to the main detective, whose name is Matty Clark. It's the middle of the night. And they've been getting a million things like this. Everybody who gets collared, he says, I'll tell you who killed the white kid. Nobody knows. And, except I know. Matty Clark has got a partner named Iacono, who's a detective, who lives in the bunk room for the last 6 months, and he just comes out every once in a while and shower clogs and a towel and a toothbrush and does some police work and then goes back in. But it's about 3 a.m., and it's the interview of the junkie. This city, Lester Kaufman said, one knee crossed over the other, a cuffed hand dangling languidly from the restraint bar. People are doing so well, you know? But you can't ask them for shit anymore. It's never been so bad. Matty grunted in sympathy. The bouncer had told Matty that the first thing this guy had said when he grabbed him after the attempted purse snatch in front of Berkman's was, let me go and I'll tell you who shot that white kid. I swear, man, Lester said to Matty for the 10th time in the last half hour. I just said that like in a panic, like the first thing that came into my head. What's left of my head. Unfortunately, Matty believed him. Lester yawned like a lion, revealing a dull steel ball pierced through his tongue. Iacone, roused from sleep for this, yawned in response. But I'll tell you, man, I'm really worried about my girlfriend. I gave her $100 to get me something, you know, get me well. She said 15 minutes and left me standing there 3 hours. I had no idea where she went, what happened to her, 15 minutes. I mean, I never would have done that if she didn't leave me there like half the night, watching everybody coming out of that place for smokes, drunk and drunk, half the damn bags right on the sidewalk. Another titanic yawn, the dull, dirty tongue pierce winking. Sucks, Iacone said. Strapped for a partner, Maddie had cajoled him out of the bunk room with the promise of overtime and an easy commute. I mean, I'm fucked, I know it, but can you just check your computer, see if she's in the system? I'm hoping she just got collared, nothing worse, but... What's her name? Anita Castro or Carla Nieves? Iacone rose and went to the computer on Yolanda's desk. Where'd you get $100, Lester? Maddie asked. Where? He shivered, then coughed into his fist. Oh, man, you don't want to make extra work for yourself with questions like that. No? Seriously? Maddie let it slide. Nothing, Iacone called out. Did you check Brooklyn? Lester asked. Nah, just Manhattan. Can you check Brooklyn? She scores on South 2nd, South 3rd. No one scores in Manhattan anymore. Manhattan's dead. You guys took care of that. Lester recrossed his knees, a slice of grimy red long johns peeking out between his pale blue ankle and the cuff of his jeans. I mean, what the hell happened to her? She was going to take me to the hospital. I have fluid in my lungs. It's no problem. We'll get someone to take you as soon as we're finished. Nothing, Iacone called out. She got a third name? She's not in the system, huh? Jesus, what do you think happened to her? He asked Maddie. And me here, this is a felony too, right? Not necessarily. Depends how you say what you say. You know, vis-a-vis sincerity, remorse. I am remorseful. I didn't menace. I didn't threaten. I didn't say anything. What's it, terroristic? All right, just capture that in your statement. In fact, if you want, we can even write your statement for you. But Lester, what can I tell you that you haven't heard a million times before? You help us, we help. You think this could go down as a pet law? I picked the fucking thing up off the sidewalk. I didn't even think anybody was going to notice when that big black guy started running after me. I was like, here, take it. I don't even get to open the damn thing. I have no idea what was in there. Obviously, I'm not a pro at this. Now, don't get down on yourself, Iacone said from Yolanda's... Iacone said from Yolanda's desk. You know, I gotta say, right now, we're pretty much eating out of garbage cans, me and Anita. But a few years ago, we had us a store worth like $200,000. Oh, yeah? Maddie's turned to yawn. What kind of store? Was like a punk boutique? No kidding. Can I have a cigarette? Jesus, I gotta get to the emergency room. All right, Maddie clapped his hands. Here we go. One time offer. Fuck the guys who shot that kid. Just give us a stick-up team. Just some names. Anybody you know works the hood. They check out. Not only do you get a pass here, but we take you to the ER, get you squared away, then we go look for your girl. A stick-up team? Lester shrugged, recrossed his legs, looked away. You know, she used to use Carmen Lopez. That was like her professional name at this one place out in Massapequa. She was a bar dancer, exotic, very good, very popular, had her regulars, guys who liked to see her. And she could go to their houses, some of them, borrow $30, $40, but she's 5 months pregnant now, so. Resting his brow on the curve of his free hand. I don't know. Maybe it's time to go upstate. It's getting too hard out here, you know? And the very last thing is one last adventure of the Quality of Life Squad, a shorty. At 11 that evening, Gerard Mush Mashburn, 3 weeks out of Rikers, sat cuffed in the back of the Quality of Life taxi, Gehagen riding next to him, Daly and Lugo up front. When Daly slipped on the baseball glove wedged between the dashboard and the window and absently started pounding its pocket, Mush piped up, "You got to put some tongue oil in that thing." "Put what?" Daly twisted around. "Oh, fuck me," Lugo grinned through the rearview. "We got Field of Dreams back there." "Knew a shortstop in high school, used bacon grease," Mush said. "Now that was a glove with some flex to it." "You a ball player, Mush?" Gehagen asked. "Was. Left field, right, first, second, you name it, I played it. Junior year, made all county honorable mention." "No kidding, what county?" "Chemung in upstate, and we had some ball players around there." "So how'd you go from that to this?" Daly mimed, shooting up. Mush looked out the window, shrugging. "Why ask why?" "You want to come play for Quality of Life?" Lugo asked. "We'll light some big bats this year." "Yeah, that would be good. Make a team out of your collars," Mush said. "You put your snatch and grabbers around the horn. You know, good hands, quick on their feet. You strong on boys in the outfield. And yeah, killer behind the plate. Get the batters all distracted and shit." The cops beamed at each other, chucking thumbs at the joker in the back seat. Seeing this, Mush warmed to his audience, just a trace of anxiety in the unconscious and repetitive flick of his tongue. "Now, just make sure none of your sideline coaches are substance abusers. You know, base runners trying to read all that scratching and nodding. You know, don't know whether to shit, piss, or wind their watch." The cops were straight out howling now, bucking in their seats with glee. Now, to pitch you, he could be a problem. Give me a minute here. No, 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 I got that one, Lugo said, seeking Mush's eyes through the rear view again. You know who'd be perfect? Anybody you call tonight could bring us a gun. Thank you. I could just tell you in a nutshell what brought me to the book and you know, what the book's about. And this book's about $26. I've always wanted to write about the Lower East Side. The Lower East Side, you know, it morphed over the last 100 years from, you know, probably the most important neighborhood in American history. The Eastern Europeans got off the boat, collapsed on Ludlow Street, took a look around, and realized they had to get the hell out of there. And it caused about 50 years of frantic success. Then it evolved into, after World War II, up until about the 80s, it became more and more dangerous, became like a huge heroin market. In the 90s, Giuliani came in with Giuliani time, which means anybody who so much as lights up a cigarette goes to jail. That and the fact that real estate needed a place to go, it all of a sudden became like the new Lower East Side, and all these young kids in their 20s started, you know, coming from all over to announce it. It was like being in Rent, but with a credit card. And that's the way people think of it now. But I always wanted to write about it. And at first I started thinking about, well, you got to write historically about the Lower East Side. You know, it's the law. And then I just realized, man, it's been done. I didn't grow up down there. Henry Roth did. What am I going to do? That's better. You know, but when I went down there, I got an eyeball. There's about six worlds that, off the top of my head, besides the new La Bohemers, there's the Orthodox Jews. There's a massive population of Fujianese Chinese. You know, a lot of them illegals living in the same density and poverty as the Jews did 110 years ago. You got the housing project culture, which is Hispanic and black mostly. You got the unrehabbed tenements, the ones that haven't been touched by real estate lava, you know, below Delancey Street. And there's still a mix and match of Hispanic and Chinese and, you know, geezer crackpot hippie, you know, and there's some other group I'm not even thinking of. But the people ignore each other. They all occupy the same physical space, but they don't acknowledge each other's existence. It's not hostile. It's just oblivious. The Chinese don't see the Jews, who don't see the yuppies, who don't see the blacks, you know, who don't see the Hispanics, who don't see the yuppies, who don't see the, you know, except every once in a while, about 3 o'clock in the morning, a couple of kids from the projects will go out into, you know, Zagatsville, part of the Lower East Side, and, you know, brace a couple of, you know, bar hopping kids from Minnesota or someplace and flash a gun and hope to get, you know, 20, 40, 60 bucks or whatever they got on them and go grab some Chinese food and, or, you know, get up on a package or something. But, you know, every once in a while, the kid who has a gun in his face, he's never had a gun in his face before, he's not particularly street smart, is loaded, you know, bombed, and either says something provocative or even worse, like steps to the gun. The kid with the gun pulls the trigger. You got 5 days of headlines because the media loves. Their favorite victim is somebody who comes to New York with stars in their eyes, you know, and finds, you know, fate on the sidewalk. You know, I mean, they revere that. And media is the tail that wags the police dog. And so if it hits the papers, the police got to be all over it. If it doesn't hit the papers, you know, they'll do what they have to do. So the book is about an investigation into, like, one of these robberies turned homicides. And also, for me, it was a personal thing. I mean, I didn't grow up there, but, you know, I had all four grandparents, like every other person in New York. Their family started out there, and my kids are down there now. Except my kids, what they knew about the Lower East Side was where you don't get carded, where the best music is, where the best clubs are, you know. But what I don't think they were sure about was the fact that maybe 110 years ago, their great-grandfather, you know, was getting put in cuffs for beating somebody up for money to pay the rent, you know. And, I mean, then I realized, like, a lot of these kids down there, they've completed a 5-generation full cycle, like my kids. You know, and they're completely oblivious to the fact that this is where it all started. This is in this country, but now they're down there licking gelatos. So I just wanted to somehow put all that together, and I chose a homicide like this because it's just a very complicated terrain, and I just thought if you follow a homicide or a major crime, it's like someone said, it's a lazy man's way through a plot. You know, just follow it. It's a very orderly line, and it takes in very different parts of the world down there. And so that's what I did again. So I'll take any questions. We apparently wait for the microphone. It's like an S meeting. You know. There's somebody over there. To your left.
I noticed on the wire, obviously, you know a lot of the police jargon and some of the things that have happened in police work, because I happen to know that because I'm a retired police captain, so it's obvious that you intermingled with some police folks to get some inside traits. I was wondering what some of those were, some of the jovial things that you had in there, such as the lie detector test on the copying machine. I don't know if that was yours or somebody else's.
Well, it's, you know, like, you know, if I'm understanding the question right, it's how did I get all the stuff that I got, the nuances, the small stuff, the gallows humor. It's just, it was just there. I mean, the way I work is that I just go to the place that I want to write about, and I open up a conversation with someone, and I get into it, and I tell them what I'm up to doing, and then that person says, oh, well, then you got to talk to so-and-so. I talk to so-and-so, and it winds up being passed around. I mean, the thing with the police is that it was very tough getting permission through channels, and I had a friend who's a columnist, Michael Daly, and he made a call for me, and that got me in the door with the precinct commander at the Lower East Side. And apparently the guy either read something I wrote or saw a movie I wrote, and he said, what do you want? Anything. At which point I completely froze. I couldn't think of anything. But to make a long story short, I spent a goodly amount of time in with guys, the uniforms and people in the squad, and just sort of, you know, just following them wherever they thought it was okay for me to follow them. And but it was the same. They did the same thing with restaurant managers, community outreach workers. You know, just anybody who would have me. I just spent a lot of time with people. I'm a great believer in osmosis. I wasn't taking notes. I didn't have any questions. But sometimes you don't even know how much you don't know, you know, until the end of a tour. Then, like, you didn't even know you didn't know that. You didn't even know that thing existed. And, you know, and I spoke and I talked to people all the time. I mean, I just said, look, here's what I'm doing. Now, if you were in a situation, would you do this, or is this too out of whack? You know, and so people, you know, got in on the... sort of like I was writing with a bunch of heads over my shoulders. That's basically how I worked with everybody. Somebody right here.
Hello. You've come across, as I thought you might, in a very bright and personable manner. Now, this is the New Yorker from this week. I just got it in the mail today.
Yeah, it looked like something Edgar Allan Poe forgot to dig.
Yeah. Out of the shadows, very dark. And yet, I've seen four or five photos in which you seem kind of dour. I wonder if that's a reflection of what you're encountering on the streets. Is that part of a reasoned public persona? Because it doesn't jive.
That's my wife. Actually, when I look like that sort of sepulchral dour and stuff, it's because I'm not drinking. But you cannot get through a book tour without drinking some a lot more attractive and sprightly now. But not yet tonight. I was on a Charlie Rose show a couple of years ago. It was a panel about legalizing drugs, and everybody on the panel was for legalizing drugs. And I was against it because they weren't specifying what drugs. You're talking about cocaine, you're talking about heroin. I mean, what are you legalizing exactly? And but, you know, all these guys, they say, oh, they do it in Lucerne, Switzerland, da, da, da. And I was the only guy saying, well, I don't have enough information. I don't think you should legalize drugs. And some right-wing columnist the next day, who obviously didn't want to legalize drugs either, said, while I was listening to these, you know, namby-pamby idiot liberals, you know, prattle on about legalizing drugs, and then came a deadly croak from the end of the table, and a voice saying, I don't think it's a good idea. And then you saw a near-death face, who you know has been there, and has been... And let me tell you something. At that point, I wasn't smoking, I wasn't drinking, I had a trainer, I was in the best shape of my life. Plus, I thought the guy was an asshole. I mean, you know, I wasn't, you know, I'm not on anybody's conservative agenda, you know. I just didn't want to legalize drugs right there, you know, but it's just, I always get that thing. But anyways, this is neither here nor there, but... Oh, I'm sorry, there's somebody right there.
How much of the plot did you know by the when you started the book?
Well, the question is, how much of the plot? Well, usually what happens is I don't have the plot until almost like the middle of the process. So I go down there, and, you know, the thing that drew me to this story was just this, you know, the compulsion to write about the Lower East Side. And it's, I did the same thing with Clockers. I just wanted to write about, you know, the socioeconomics of crack and the relationship between the projects and the police, you know. And I was down there. It's sort of like I knew I was on the right street. I just didn't have the house number. And about after 6 months of doing this, you know, somebody talked about a case where some kid was killed like this, and it just took a light bulb went off. But the plot's almost like an afterthought, unfortunately, for me a lot of the time. So I'm honestly more into like the voices and the texture of a place. You know, I feel more like a camera, you know, like a photographer than I do a, it's like I want to bear witness. I just want to see everything, and then I got to find a frame to hang it on. This is why a lot of times I'll resort to, you know, a criminal investigation because of the orderliness it imposes, you know. But it was at least a year before the plot came to me. Yeah, there's somebody right there.
Were you doing this while you were writing for The Wire, or did this happen after?
Yeah, I was kind of doing, yeah. Both. I mean, I was writing for The Wire. I wrote 5 episodes. I'm getting such a free ride off those 5 episodes. I mean, but no, The Wire wasn't that much work. It was, you know, it was a couple of days in Baltimore, you know, having story meetings. And then by the time you leave, you know, you've got a stack of index cards with every scene that you're going to do in your episode. And then you just go home and you flesh them out. It's like, you know, it's a couple of days of meeting with the people down there and a couple of weeks writing, and you're sort of done. And you get, you know, when your paycheck comes, you know, the envelope opens up and some moth comes out. And so, you know, it all evened out that way. But, yeah, I mean, I can't write two different forms at the same time. Usually, you know, I was, you know, waiting until a time where I know I was done with a certain draft. Okay, now, but I can't write for two mediums at the same time, so I was just trying to time it right. Yes?
Can you tell us something about the political world and the political figures from The Wire? Thank you.
You know what? The question is if I could tell us something about the political world. I had the most trouble with... So the difference between The Wire, Clockers... David Simon told me that Clockers was sort of the inspiration for The Wire, and you see a lot of Clockers in the first... in the a lot of the cops and kids stuff. But he took it way past that. I mean, his whole thing was so panoramic, it went straight up to the State Assembly of Maryland. And I learned, just like you learned watching The Wire, like how things work. I mean, I needed a lot of help because I don't know how people talk to each other. I got some assemblyman from Prince George's County blackmailing the mayor of Baltimore for his support for governor in exchange for a piece of this education grant money coming down through the state of Maryland. And I never knew that stuff. And once somebody explains it to me, I can write it. But the answer is no, I can't. You know, just I watch The Wire just like everybody else. I don't even understand some of my own scripts. Yeah, there's somebody over here.
Hi, I was interested hearing you say that the different ethnic groups in the Lower East Side don't communicate with each other? Because I heard you say another time that what you like about the street, people at the street level, is everybody, I don't want to say gets along. They all have to negotiate with each other. They all have to deal with each other. It doesn't matter if they're white or black, who they are. They have to coexist. So that seemed to be somewhat of a contradiction.
Well, not really, because we're talking about people who have no need to interact with each other. You know, these young kids from Minnesota, they have nothing to do with the Fujinese living in their building, you know, except maybe that they would like the door lock to work, but they've got 25 guys in that apartment up there coming and going all hours. When I said that people negotiate with each other, I was talking more about, like, what people would think of as, you know, polar opposites, like cops and robbers, you know, and... What I find and what fascinates me is the negotiations that go on between, you know, today you let this guy go, you'll catch him some other day because he's going to give you information that's going to help you do your job, and this way he gets to stay free, you know, so it's this mutual thing. You know, and there's not a lot of animus. I mean, when it's the quality of life guy, when they stop guy, they know they're doing bullshit stuff. I mean, it's just, you know, in another precinct they wouldn't do that because they're too busy. You know, but they just have to generate the numbers. And they know they're kind of, like, messing with these kids. And these kids half the time know that they're being messed with. But they know also, you know, you don't get in a cop's face no matter what, no matter how wrong you are or how wrong they are. I mean, you know, cops are as sensitive as street kids when it comes to disrespect. You know, so everybody sort of plays the game. I saw something I try to write about and try to tell this story pretty succinctly. I was with two of these guys in front of Quality of Life Squad. And, you know, the tour was over, and they were, like, sort of driving to some place to get hammered. And they pass a guy on a bicycle, black guy with dreadlocks, about 30 years old, and there's, like, a 9-year-old white kid on the crossbars. You know, and as they're driving by, they're looking at each other. And they look at the time and say, it's fucking midnight. And I said, does that look right to you? And they don't have anything other than just, like, that doesn't look right to me. So they find a reason to stop the bike. And, you know, they go into a whole thing about, you know, you're supposed to be wearing a helmet. You know, you're in violation of something. At which point they take the kid, this 9-year-old kid, and they separate the kid from the guy. And the black guy starts following where the kid's going. He said, whoa, you stay here with me. Don't look at him. Look at me. Well, what are you doing? And they start interrogating this. Not interrogating, but they start talking. Do you know who that is? To the kid. He goes, yeah, that's you know, Cleveland. You know, really, that's Cleveland. How well do you know him? Do you know where he lives? Where were you going? Do you know where you might? You know, and the kid's answering all these questions, and he's wound pretty tight, and he's 9 years old. And meanwhile, I'm bouncing back and forth between the two groups, and... You know, the other cop with the black guy, he's got his mag light out, and he's looking at his ID, and he says, well, where were you taking him? You know, and he says, okay, have a seat on the sidewalk. But this guy knows that this is a bullshit stop. He knows why they're stopping him, because it's a white kid he's got, and it's midnight. But he knows not to get in this cop's face. It's only going to get worse. So he's sort of forced to, you know, I think, I would imagine that, you know, any non-white adult in this city has lived here long enough knows what the odds are. If, you know, you just smile, at least from the nose down, you know, and you just deal with it. It's just survival. And finally, at one point, the cop that's with the kid says to him, so you've been alone with him in his house? He says, yes. Yeah. Well, what do you do? He says, well, we watch TV. And I show, he tried to teach me how to make scrambled eggs and da-da-da-da. He says, do you do anything else with him? And the kid goes, like, what? You know, and the kid gets all kind of stalky. He says, and the cop says, do you see this? And he shows this, but you know what this is? He goes, yeah, it's a badge. He says, you know what that means? It means you're a policeman. That's right. You know what that also means? That means you can tell me anything you want, and you're perfectly safe. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? And all of a sudden, the kid gets tears in his eyes, and I could tell the cop, his heart's pumping Kool-Aid. He's going, oh, shit, you know. And the kid bursts into tears, and he says, if you fucking assholes arrest him one more time because he's black and I'm white, I'm going to kill myself. You came into our house because our crazy neighbor said he was raping my mom. You know, you took him away from me at the street fair, and my mom had to come get him. And the kid went through this whole litany of bullshit things like this. And the cop is, whoa, 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 you know. And You know, and meanwhile, the guy's still there, and he can't get chesty with anybody. So, you okay there, buddy? He said, hey, didn't they say don't look at him? And finally, the guy said, listen, why don't you call the kid's mother and you know, put this to bed? And they did, and it was legit. It was the mother's boyfriend. And he was taking the kid home from a sleepover date. You know, and then, but it's funny because the cops didn't, like, apologize. They gave him, like, some half-assed lecture about safety and helmets and stuff like that. But from their point of view is something didn't look right. And we'd rather piss people off and check. You know, because 14 out of 15 times we might look like hostile assholes. The 15th time we're going to save some kid. Who knows? And I remember, but, you know, I'm a writer and I'm in the car with them. And, they're not stupid. They know there's a writer in the back. And they couldn't have felt what anything that they were doing was wrong because it was perfectly fine to do in front of a writer. But and all I wanted to do was bear witness to this and write it the way I saw it. I wasn't going to pass judgment on everybody. Everybody had their point of view of why they did what they did. But I do remember being in a car with these guys, and they were driving on and about two blocks, and it was really silent. And finally, one cop turns to the other and says, you know something? Still seems fishy to me. And the other cop says, hey, we gave it a shot. That's all we can do. You know, so that's the world, you know. Yeah.
As a young writer or as a middle-aged writer, how did you land on this kind of osmosis, kind of soak-it-up kind of writing?
Well, that's a good question, because I started out, I wrote four novels that were all self-referential, because I used to feel like the only thing you could write about is stuff you personally experienced. And so I was like 31 years old and I had four novels. It's like my therapist was bored to tears. And I took off. I quit writing novels because I just didn't have anything else to write about. And I started writing screenplays because it was money. You know, it was being a writer for hire. I could keep writing without the pressure of being like an author, you know. And but in the process of writing screenplays, I have to write about what they want to hire me for. So I had to go out and learn about pool hustlers. I had to learn about for Color Money. I had to learn about cops for Sea of Love. I mean, I had to learn about boxers for Night in the City. You know, and I realized that you're not beholden to your autobiography and your talent are not Siamese twins. You know, you can go out into the world and you can learn something. And if you've got enough empathy and if you've got enough imagination, you can go home and take what you learned and make it yours. And it was extremely liberating because when I went back to novels, that's what I did with Clockers. And I've pretty much done that all the time. And, I mean, a lot of times when I teach, and I teach on and off all my adult life writing, you know, one of the things that I try to tell, you know, especially young writers like college kids, is they feel like they don't know what to write about. And they're right, you know. It's like they're 18 years old. What are they going to write? The dorm, you know. I went home for Thanksgiving. You know, I hate my parents. I didn't like being back in my childhood bedroom. My high school girlfriend screwing somebody else. You know, it's everybody's got the same drill. You know, and then it dawned on me. So, well, you don't have to write about what you know. You can go out and you can learn something. I mean, sometimes you want to find yourself, get lost. You know, what out there intrigues you? Put yourself someplace, learn something, bring back the world. You know. And, you know, it's one option. I mean, some people never have to leave, you know, their internal musings, you know, and they're better writers than I'll ever be. You know, a lot of people, I remember somebody once said that the greatest literature is when the smallest amount of external event creates the greatest amount of internal revolution. You know, that's one way to go. I mean, that's the Edith Wharton way, you know. I guess I'm more like Robert Louis Stevenson or something. I don't know. But I like it. I mean, autobiography seeps into everything you write anyhow. You know, every character is you. Every choice they make is informed by what you would do. I mean, you are the characters, so. Yes.
I just wondered if you felt anything different writing about an actual New York as opposed to Dempsey, New Jersey, where a bunch of the earlier stuff took place.
Yeah, I mean, I did, because I made up for Clockers, Freedom Land, Samaritan. I sort of made up a generic city, which is really based on Jersey City. And I didn't call it Jersey City because I didn't want people reading it and thinking, oh, this is how it is in Jersey City. Because I felt like, you know, the universal dynamics are so much greater than the differences between Baltimore and Newark and Jersey City and Camden. And, you know, they have much more in common than they have differences. So I wanted Dempsey to be the city closest to the reader. This time, what drew me to this project was the place itself. That's the main character, the Lower East Side. So I was beholden. And it wasn't journalism. I mean, I made up my story, but, you know, I just really wanted to capture the true texture of what it's like there in such flux right now. I mean, the Lower East Side was the main character. Two more questions. Somebody make the decision, not me. Come on, you got microphones, bearers.
I wanted to ask you, when I lived in New York, they had a lot of wolf packs going around, grabbing older people, beating them up and killing them. It's been happening a lot in Philadelphia. It's mostly black on white. And the police department can't seem to find these kids, even though they know who they are. Can it be political why they don't make arrests?
Here's what I'd say about that. First of all, I think, you know, everybody thinks of crime as black on white. I think, you know, if a lot of the perps are non-white, probably all the victims are non-white, too. For every white person that gets mugged, there's 100 black people that get mugged. I mean, people tend to stay home, you know, when they're going to do mayhem. I mean, people stay in their neighborhoods. I mean, the victims, you know, the difference is when something hits the papers, that's when everybody gets all exercised. But here's where the tail wags the dog. When I was writing Clockers, I went out with the crime scene unit, which responds to all the homicides in the five boroughs, and it was the height of the crack epidemic. It was about 1989. And I would say over the course of a year, I went to 30-odd murders with bodies at the scene. I would say 28 of them, the victims were black or Hispanic. And not one of those 28 murders did I see a camera, a newspaper person, or police brass. The two times the victims were white, I saw cameras and I saw white-haired cops with brass buttons, which I never saw before. Well, I don't know. That depends on a case by case. But, you know, listen, I think they'll put everybody, you know, wants to do their job, but, you know, there's certain pressures from above when the media gets involved. And I don't know the statistics of what you're talking about. But I do know this also, and this is kind of really interesting. There's a thing in New York called Night Watch. There's no detective squads between 1 a.m. and 8 a.m. What they have instead is a pool of detectives, four permanent people and four guys who sign up for the overtime. And they're responsible for any kind of potential felony that happens in New York City for those hours. They have to respond to everything. And one of the sergeants in the Night Watch was trying to teach me something. He said there was a stabbing in Harlem, and it was like a couple of like Albanian guys with gold chains got confronted in the black area, and one guy got stabbed and a chain was snatched. And so he was in charge of sending people out. He said, all right, you and you go to the scene. You and you go to Harlem Hospital. They always split up the guys. You know, the guys go into the hospital, get there, interview the guy. You and you go to the scene, canvas for witnesses. And he says, we're going to wait an hour, and then we're going to go up, and I'm going to teach you something. So we go up to Harlem Hospital, and he gets there, and he sees the detective there, and he says, so what do you got? He said, well, the victim's in there. He's not exactly sure what street he was on when it happened. He says, all right, well, who brought him in? He says, well, a couple of other Albanian guys. He says, where are they? He said, they left. And he said, well, did you get their names? He goes, well, I told them to wait, and I said, I wanted to go see how the guy was doing, and then I was going to take, but they left. And the cop is looking at him, and he knows he fucked up. And the cop says to the sergeant, well, you know, I'll put that in my report. And then the sergeant says, do yourself a favor. Don't put that in your report. And then he looked at me and he said, 96th Street. You can fuck up as much as you want north of 96th Street. You can basically, people can get away with murder. Anything below 96th Street, it's all hands on deck. If the victim was in Soho or Tribeca, you know, and this guy screwed up like this, he would be pounding a beat in Staten Island. But above 96, it's about press. It's, you know, it's about who gets the ink. 96th Street, nobody, you know, like I said, people do their jobs, but it's a different kind of energy. And I think, is that it, or should one more? Yeah. I don't think that mic is on.
If you ever think about your characters after you write a book, did Emilio Capra ever implode, or did he retire?
I don't think of my characters, but the people that I hung out with when I write about them, I maintain relationships with. You know, their mind, they get confused with the characters. But, you know, the guys in The Wanderers, you know, like, they probably would be like retired cops by now. You know. Anyways, thank you.
Okay, well, you all right? Okay, we'll go out here.